I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush is warning today that tight credit is freezing the ability of small businesses not just to expand, but to exist. That's no pressure at all on House lawmakers who are being asked by the administration to pass the revised bailout bill, which the president and the secretary of the Treasury claim will thaw the credit freeze. We're going to speak to a congressman from Arizona who is changing his vote on the bailout bill. We'll speak to him a little later in the program, but first, were the seeds of the current crisis sown in the business schools where the corporate titans of America were educated? Ethicists are asking that question this week and asking further, what do we do now? Today we want to have a conversation about ethics in the B schools with Rakesh Khurana. He's professor of business administration at Harvard Business School, which is considered the number one B school in the nation. He's described himself as an organizational sociologist, and I think it's fair to say that he's also been looking for some reform. He's author of From Higher Aim to Hired Hands. Rakesh, welcome.
Thank you.
And, you know, we heard from analysts this week who talked about B-school grads, you know, now on Wall Street, trading bad assets to drive up the bottom line and justify their and their CEOs' huge salaries. You know, are B-schools broadly, let's not talk about Harvard for a second, but broadly to be blamed, are they leaning too much on teaching the Milton Friedman mantra from 1970 that the sole concern of American business should be the maximization of profit?
Well, I think if business schools are part of the ecology of the contemporary business culture, and it is true that many of the most sought-after jobs that business school students go after are those that you could find on Wall Street. And so I think it's important to think about what the link is between the institution of business education and the business context. I think it is important because in recent decades, the mission and the purpose of business education has changed. It shifted away from developing managers to run our long-lasting institutions as custodians and fiduciaries, and largely shifted to this view that managers and leaders, CEOs, were merely hired hands of the shareholders, and therefore you had to incent them in a way that would perfectly align their activities toward maximizing shareholder value.
You write that management has become an occupation, not a profession, and you think that fiscal managers should think of themselves as doctors or people who have to have some sort of like review of what they do.
Well, I think it's fairly clear now that the activities of business don't just have an impact on the bottom line, but are largely now affecting the challenges we face with respect to our public economic security as a nation, if not threatening the global economic security. And so the idea that one's responsibility is only to oneself or to a narrow group of individuals as shareholders, which even in that case was not effectively executed, really comes into question. And I think this presents an inflection point for business education to reconsider its point of arrival.
Well, there's, of course, talk about re-regulating Wall Street, changing Wall Street. Should Wall Street managers be somehow regulated or have some kind of code or licensing?
Well, I think it's probably going to end up being a combination of some. You know, contrary to the belief of most people, capitalism actually does require government. It requires regulations that lay out what the rules of the game are. It also requires, at some level, some effective self-governance. Otherwise, what happens is you end up in this arms race which, you know, you try to pass regulations and other people are trying to outsmart them. Without the capacity of self-governance and trust, you can't build an effective system. And the current situation, I think, right now is that the capacity of self-governance got eliminated. Just to give you one example, compensation, which you brought up earlier, is one key example. Many of the boards of directors of these companies, without really having deep comprehension of the knowledge of what the risks they were taking with these companies, felt the need to sort of load up managers with incentives that tied their activities to very short-term results, right, and take risks that now have put their enterprises out in great danger.
Well, you say maybe have different incentives and different coding, but isn't it about changing the way people think? I mean, for instance, this complex swapping and bundling of mortgages that led to the current crisis wasn't, in most cases, illegal. So if ethics courses are teaching future business leaders legality, isn't that different from teaching social responsibility?
I think that's a very important point because I think it goes right to the heart of it. These tools that are created are merely tools. And if you just train people in the tools without the normative orientation of how they should use the tools, what you've created are mercenaries. And without putting that these tools have to be used for advancing the economic interests of the firm and the economic interests of the society, without socializing students into that, without putting a governance system, whether it's the combination of an oath, a combination of the capacity to self-regulate, you've created dynamite.
Well, that's Rakesh Khurana, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. Again, he's author of From Higher Aims to Hired Hands. We want to ask him more about his thinking about what's being taught in B schools. But we also know that many schools, Harvard is one. We want to talk about what Harvard has done to sort of respond to fiscal crisis, including the Enron crisis. Babson, a business school here in the Boston area, is way out front in teaching social responsibility. And apparently it is having some impact. We want to turn now for just a minute and wait right there, Rakesh, to Gary Hirschberg. He's chair, president, and CEO of Stonyfield Farm. That's, of course, the organic yogurt producer that became a part of the French conglomerate Danone in 2001. Now, Gary is part of a movement to bring social responsibility to business, but he's also been a gadfly in that movement, pushing for progressive companies to work with the Walmarts of the world to make them more green, more local, more ethical. Tomorrow, Gary is going to teach a masterclass to 75 Yale grad students, Rakesh. They're studying environmental management and business practices. And we've got Gary on the line. Gary, you've worked with students before who are studying business. What do you think of their attitudes towards ethics in business?
The students coming up today, Robin, are way ahead of previous generations. They see the train wreck that is the 20th century in terms of how we've treated the environment, the disparity between rich and poor, and recognize that business is probably the most powerful force needed to reverse these trends.
Well, this may be why these particular students are coming to work with you at the company, but we hear that business students at large, you know, still think that an MBA is a ticket to $1 million salary.
I'm not sure that you're going to be hearing that this week.
Yeah.
Last week, the Department of Labor reported that we lost 2 million jobs in the last 12 months. And at the same time, the University of Massachusetts released a report on the impact of clean energy. And this independent analysis predicted that $100 billion of investment in clean energy will create 2 million jobs nationally. So I think what MBAs who are paying attention will see is that the 20th century is over. And we need an entirely different relationship to our workers, to our supply chains, and to the planet.
Well, when your company, Stonyfield Farm, entered into its partnership with Danone, you retained control of Stonyfield Farm. But there are a lot of critics who said you sold out. And one of the problems we're seeing on Wall Street is that the bigger the company, the harder it is to catch bad practices like buying and selling of bad mortgage debt. So how do you respond, first of all, to the criticism, and how do you tell students to walk that fine line of wanting or maybe needing to grow a business while being mindful that smaller and local is the way to control ethics?
Well, Stonyfield has had a compounded growth rate over 18 years of over 24% annually. And while that may sound anti-capitalistic, it's got the attention of B schools everywhere. And so what I counsel students is stick to your ethics. Stick to core values of taking care of the planet, taking care of those so-called externalities, and the dollars will flow as a result.
But Gary, how do you respond to students who say, wait a second, if I'm going to the future Lehman Brothers, it's not there right now, or Goldman Sachs, then, you know, I don't even see what I'm doing. I don't see trees or paper. I see numbers on a screen, you know, and I'm told I got to drive up the bottom line and the results for the shareholders. They don't talk about products the way you do. They don't talk about cows, you know. They're trading these securities with mortgages that they don't even have people's names. These are things that are all bundled together. How do they think of ethics when they're watching a big board on the floor of Wall Street?
Well, I think it's an excellent question, and the obvious answer, as we've just seen evidence in a very dramatic way, is that there has been no there. We've been trading and borrowing with no genuine collateral, no genuine values underlying all those transactions. And my point is that the future opportunities for young folks who want to make a lot of money, who want to move into Wall Street, are to look at those fundamentals, look at energy flows, look at the outflow of dollars out of our economy for resources that could be provided locally. You're absolutely correct. If they just see it as a bunch of numbers on a board, then they're just going to continue to repeat the same errors that got us into this mess in the first place.
Gary Hirschberg, Chair, President, and CEO of Stonyfield Farm, I'm going to be speaking to 75 Yale grad students tomorrow, coming up to maybe learn something about social responsibility and business. Gary, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
And we're back in the studio with Rakesh Khurana, who is a professor at Harvard Business School, who has been talking about reform in the B schools. And Rakesh, there we see Yale students coming up to learn more about social responsibility. Yale added a program called Ethics and Spirituality in the Workplace. Johns Hopkins has a program to turn out more socially responsible leadership. And Harvard, your school, began a mandatory leadership and corporate accountability course after the Enron mess. And maybe we're hearing the results of these students who want to know about this. But same question to you. How hard is it to get that kid who's been for 10 years expecting he had a ticket to be a millionaire on Wall Street if he got an MBA? How to reach him?
Well, I think this is where the big challenge is, because I do believe that these courses that focus on individual ethics and the things that Mr. Hirschberg has done are important questions. The challenge is that it's the institutional ethics that are important, which is it's fine to go through those classes in which you say, you know, can you look yourself in the mirror in the morning and you know, what do you want to be doing? But the challenge is at the business level, and it's where the capacity for self-governance, where it's not just what you think, but you're embedded in an organization, you're embedded in the market, you're embedded in seeing these numbers on the screen, where you don't see what the underlying social connection is, where you're dealing with things that can't be inventoried. They're abstractions. They're not imbued with any sense of social responsibility. There's no building. There's no employees. There's no products. And that abstraction, I think, and more than two-thirds of the students in elite business schools have been heading for those kinds of jobs, individual contributor jobs, jobs that are in financial services or consulting, for example, not in the jobs that have to do with interacting with the real economy in building goods and services, which was what the original intention of the founding of these business schools were.
You know, we're heading up to a break. We're going to ask you to stay on the other side of that. But as we head towards that break in a couple minutes now, what do you say to people who say that, yes, Harvard has added this course, but that, you know, schools like Babson are way ahead of Harvard? Would you agree?
Well, I think I don't know the details of the specific things, but I do think that this is something that not every individual school can do. This is actually something that collectively that business schools need to do. Too often now, business schools see each other as competitors rather than, for example, seeing themselves involved in the collective enterprise of raising the standards of business. In fact, in recent years, to the extent that the MBA education has been affected, it's largely been a race downward. That is making the program shorter. That is getting rid of required courses. And so I think it's a good sign in the consequence of the wake of these changes and in response to the loss of legitimacy that we're now seeing in business that we are seeing business schools respond. But I think the challenge is that this can't be merely temporary reactionary, that it actually requires a collective reexamination of our point of arrival.
That's Rakesh Khurana, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School, considered, again, the number one business school in the nation. But we're hearing him say that it, along with other B schools, needs a lot of improvement in turning out the future leaders heading to what's going to be a new Wall Street. You're nodding yes. It's not going to be the old Wall Street. They're going to have to change for what's ahead of them. We're going to come back with more from Rakesh. And don't forget, later in the show, if you are a student, where are you registered? Are you aware of where you can vote in the upcoming presidential election? We'll take a look at some voter registration questions. That's still ahead as well. Back with more from Rakesh Khurana in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with Rakesh Khurana, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School, and also someone who's been looking for reform. Is that fair to say, Rakesh, in how business schools teach not just ethics but social responsibility? And you've been critical of what's really valued at B School, this idea of, you know, it's a ticket to multimillionaire status on Wall Street. You say students get hired away within weeks of even starting at Harvard, right?
Yes. I mean, I think this is one of the big challenges for all business schools is that often, you know, the focus becomes very quickly on the job before even the education. One of the challenges is that really represents is what is it that we're teaching our students? Is it seen as really a technical body of knowledge? And there's a great deal of disagreement. And if we sort of define what a profession is, you know, that is an advanced school that exists in a university, a profession typically consists of an institution that has a strong body of knowledge, a system for certifying that people have mastered that knowledge, tests, licenses, a commitment to use that specialized knowledge for the benefit of society, and a code of ethics with provisions for self-governance. If we compare current management education grants those four criteria, I think we find it significantly wanting.
Yeah, well, you know, and obviously you're calling for change, but some might say, well, wait a second. Harvard Business School costs $175,000. It's a lot of money. People want a return on that investment. And further, these are the young people who are going into businesses. How do you buck a system if you're surrounded by it?
Well, I think it's important. Most of our students do want to make a difference. They don't merely want their jobs as a way of making a living, but they want a job that allows them to live out their values. The question is can we create an institutional system for doing that? Now, of course,
I have to jump in and apologize. Apparently, there's some work going on in a building near us, and our table is shaking, and your microphone just began shaking, but all is well. We're not in earthquake territory.
Okay, thank you. Continue. Well, I think, you know, for example, medical school is expensive. Law schools are expensive. But I think we have to recognize that there's a social contract that universities have with society. You know, we have nonprofit status. We enjoy great deals of benefits from that. And that right away, that creates an obligation to society. And our students have to recognize, and our own institutions have to recognize, that it's on this social contract that the legitimacy of our institution depends. Not only the legitimacy of the business school, which is important, but the legitimacy of business. To the extent that business is held in a low regard, to the extent that our citizenry holds business leaders in low regard, that affects our institutions. We'll stop getting the best and brightest coming to business schools. People will largely see this as a credentialing system rather than an education. It's those type of elements that really, I think, create a need and an urgency. And just going back to Mr. Hirschberg's earlier comments.
From Stonyfield Farm. Yeah.
The problems that we face, sustainability, global climate change, issues around entrenched inequality, business is going to have to help solve those problems. We're going to need effective managers and leaders. But we're going to need effective management leaders who have not been trained in a way of just merely seeing their self-interest as the primary guiding factors, but who see their contribution to building a better society through better organizations.
Well, in fact, Gary Hirschberg also told us that the way Babson College is teaching ethics and social responsibility is the way to go. He's a part of that program, we should say. But there, it's what you've been saying. Ethical decision-making is not just a course. It's integrated into the entire way of looking at business. Rakesh, just, you know, one last thought. As you well know, I mean, what you're saying about Harvard, I'm sure, extends to other business schools. But there was a book written about Harvard from a graduate who was a journalist, Harvard Business School. He said there was a religiosity towards making money. In the minute we have left, is that religiosity what has to change in a free market, you know, democratic society?
I think it's an uncritical view of what the role of markets are. And that uncritical view that markets actually are part of the larger social system, that they depend on regulation, they depend on effective norms, they depend on the leaders who are running them to act in trustworthy ways, that has to become embedded. And as a result, the uncritical view, which takes on the fervor of religiosity rather than the fervor of being an individual responsible for society's resources, that's the call that has to change. So we have to change the idea that management is not merely an occupation for making money, but can be a calling for producing goods and services that benefit society.
Rakesh Khurana, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School, author of From Higher Aims to Hired Hands. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, it might be one good side effect of this whole crisis is that we are having conversations like this. But back to that bailout bill and the current crisis, not a single Republican congressman from John McCain's home state of Arizona voted for the bill on Monday, but it now looks that at least one of them, Congressman John Shadegg, has changed his mind. He joins us from Washington. Congressman, we know you support some of the additions to the new revised bill, the increase in the limit on the FDIC insurance, for instance, but you say you're holding your nose on others. The thing that convinced you to change your mind, though, is the part of the bill that allows the Securities and Exchange Commission to suspend so-called mark-to-market accounting. Help us understand what you view that is and how it contributed to the credit crunch.
The best explanation I've heard of mark-to-market is it's like if you had to sell your home, but you had a year to sell it, you know you'd get a pretty decent price. But if somebody walked in and said, you got to sell your home and you have to sell it in the next hour, you would get a terrible price. You'd be in a fire sale situation, and you might get no price at all. I think that is what mark-to-market, as currently applied, has done to the value of real estate holdings in this country. And I think it's unrealistic. Nobody would sell their home in a one-hour time period.
Well, but this idea that you could sort of value something based on what it might be worth, isn't that kind of betting on something? And isn't that what got us into trouble in the first place?
No, it's not what got us into trouble in the first place. It is true that the old rule, the rule that preceded mark-to-market, was abused by some financial institutions. It was abused by Enron, for example. And we're not going back to that old rule. Well, and I would disagree with you that the changes they're proposing to mark-to-market will allow you to value it based on something you might get for it in the future. What they are looking at is just moving to a more reasonable rule where the financial institution holding the asset would set a more reasonable value, but that value would be, there would be oversight of the values they set, the Securities Exchange Commission, and by banking examiners. It wouldn't be that you can just guess as to its future value.
How much did the Wall Street plunge on Monday affect your thinking?
It didn't. I expected the Wall Street plunge. Everybody had said it. My conscience on this bill, before we were able to get mark-to-market changed and before we were able to get FDIC changed,
Arizona Congressman John Shattuck, we've run out of time. House members will vote in the next couple of days. We'll follow it for you. Back after the news here now. There are 33 days until the presidential election, and voter registration deadlines come sooner than that. So predictably, the lawsuits are flying in Ohio, California, Wisconsin, Michigan, New Mexico, Florida, over new voter laws and regulations. So let's get an overview with Doug Chapin. He's director of Pew's electionline.org. He joins us from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Doug, what are the biggest problems you're seeing this year?
Well, the fights we're seeing so far around the country seem to be focusing on voter registration. With the tremendous, likely historic level of interest we're going to see in voting across the country and the number of new voters, there have been controversies about which individuals can register and how states are managing those lists to protect the integrity of the rolls.
Well, let's take a look. Last week, Congress held a hearing entitled Ensuring the Right of College Students to Vote. Now, we know there's been confusion about the legality of students registering in their college state rather than their home state. And there was a controversy at Virginia Tech. What happened there?
Yeah, and that's a fascinating issue. Those of us who are election geeks for a living know that as important as voter registration is, it actually rests on a fairly arcane and slippery concept known as domicile. And domicile involves not just physical presence in a jurisdiction, but some kind of intention to remain there. One has to have a rootedness in the community. And over the years, not just this year, there have been tugs of war between frequently town and gown in university cities where the local registrar is somewhat doubtful of whether or not the students who are registering to vote in that locality actually intend to remain in that locality or if they're just registering in states where they think their votes will have the greatest impact.
Well, let's talk more about that. First of all, what's the law? Because we thought that the Supreme Court in 1979 guaranteed that college students had the right to register and vote in the district where they attended school. So legally, they have that right.
They do legally have that right. The issue is always whether or not they are properly domiciled in that jurisdiction. So while students have the right to register where they attend school, there is still that state law issue of domicile that frequently leads to some confusion between registration groups and the local election official.
Well, for instance, some states don't accept P.O. boxes or dorm residences as an address.
Exactly. And again, there the issue is, does a P.O. box or a dormitory address suggest some lack of rootedness in the community? Now, lots of college students will tell you that no matter how small the dorm room is, many of them do consider that home and do consider themselves members of their local community. And so most states and most state laws, it's up to the voter to decide where she is properly domiciled. And then if there are any challenges to that, it's her responsibility to demonstrate that domicile.
But can students lose their tax status or their scholarship if they register to vote at their college address?
if you are a student who perhaps has a certain geographic scholarship that you need to be a resident of state X in order to be a recipient of that scholarship, that could happen. Without knowing the absolute specifics of each individual case, it's hard to say. But I think what isn't true is that across the board, you cannot vote in your college town without losing scholarship or tax status for your parents. Bright lines really don't apply in this situation.
The State Board of Elections there in Virginia came in and revised the guidelines to say that a dorm or college address could be acceptable as a residential address for voter registration in Virginia. But these are the kinds of issues that have come up. And on the other side of the equation, you know, the townies, the people, the locals who live in college towns, really don't like the idea of kids who are maybe only going to be there for 4 years having an impact on the voting there.
Yeah, and you've absolutely put your finger on it. I think that this really more often is less about a partisan dispute than it is a town versus gown, sort of the locals versus the transients. It just gets more attention because it's in the white-hot glare of the presidential race.
Well, a 2006 study by the Institute for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement, that's at Salisbury University in Maryland, found 11 states, including Virginia, making it more difficult for college students to vote where they go to school. You can go to our website, here-now.org, to learn more about the student registration rules for every state. But I want to move on to Ohio, another swing state, where there's a lawsuit over a new requirement that election officials mail notices to voters 60 days before an election. This year, as many as 600,000 of those notices were returned. Might those be the basis for voter challenges?
That's certainly the fear you hear from voter registration advocates. There is a growing concern over what advocates call vote caging, and that term is taken from the returned mail cage at a post office, the idea being that if you mail a postcard to Doug Chapin at 123 Main Street and it comes back undeliverable, then that is evidence that he doesn't live at that address. And the fear is that maybe individuals who are legitimately registered at that address and for whatever reason the mail comes back will be challenged at the polls and either outright stricken or just discouraged from voting.
Well, and that also brings us to the issue of foreclosure, because the thousands, millions of Americans whose homes have been foreclosed on may also not get those notices. We'll take a look at that issue separately, though. But Doug Chapin, in Florida, there's a new and controversial no-match, no-vote law. It's causing some problems. Explain that.
The issue there is a requirement for states and localities to begin matching their new statewide voter registration databases, which were mandated by the Federal Help America Vote Act of 2002, matching them against other sources of information to verify that individuals are indeed resident at the address where they are registered to vote. If there is no match and local election officials are unable to cure the problem, the name will essentially be stricken from the rolls, hence the name No Match, No Vote.
We're reading that if voters use a nickname or if they misspell a name, you know, they could be one of the applications that gets flagged and their registration could be held up. And in that case, they're going to be notified by mail. And this is obviously no fraud, just a mistake. Florida Governor Charlie Crist said residents will have enough time to resolve the problem. But a lot of people are asking him to suspend this law until after the election. They don't feel there's enough time. There's not a lot of time between now and the election.
Undoubtedly. And look, the issue there really is, if there is no match, what level of effort will the government go to? What level of effort will be expected from the voter? And who will get the benefit of the doubt if essentially we run out of time before Election Day? The current policy in Florida is that at some point, if the state can't verify that the individual on the roll is the individual who is alleged to be on the roll, that they will not allow them to vote. That's why really voters everywhere should verify their registration before Election Day and certainly before the close of registration in their state, and then deal with any problems that may have arisen.
Doug Chapin, director of Pew's electionline.org, speaking to us from the NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Is there one thing in particular you're going to be watching on Election Day, or one potential problem?
I think the big thing to watch nationwide on Election Day is going to be turnout. We are almost undoubtedly facing a record number of voters on Election Day. And while election officials across the country say and mean that they want every eligible American to cast a ballot, we simply don't have the system to handle anywhere near 100% turnout. And so I think what to watch on Election Day was whether or not the system can stand up under the load that voters are likely to place on it.
Doug, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now. So where do you vote if your home has been foreclosed? Well, more than a million Americans have lost their home through foreclosure in the last 2 years. Some are still in the process, still in the house. Some have moved to new addresses and re-registered. And a number are sleeping in a car, on a friend's couch, or in a homeless shelter. If a letter from their election registrar is sent to their former foreclosed home, it would be returned. And as we just heard, there's concern that those voters will be challenged at the polls. Local election officials and voting rights groups are trying to clear up the confusion because the rules vary state by state. So let's take a look at Michigan, a swing state with some of the highest foreclosure rates in the country. Now, the issue came to a head there last month in Macomb County after a local online publication, the Michigan Messenger, reported that the county's Republican chair, James Carabelli, said Republicans would challenge people on foreclosure lists in November. Now, that report was denied by the GOP, and Carabelli filed a defamation suit against the Michigan Messenger. But the Messenger is sticking by its report, and Senator Barack Obama's campaign filed a lawsuit in federal court to prohibit the state GOP from using foreclosure lists to challenge voters. Well, Carmela Sabaugh is Macomb County Clerk, Register of Deeds. Carmela, first of all, what are the rules? If someone has received a foreclosure notice, what are the rules as to how they vote?
If a person, you know, gets that foreclosure list, they have within 60 days from the election that they can still vote at that precinct. You know, if they have moved out prior to that 60 days, they've had ample time to re-register.
So you're saying that if it's within 60 days of Election Day, they can still just vote from that address. If the foreclosure was 60 days before Election Day, they should have re-registered. But what if they don't know that? I mean, what are people telling you?
Well, you know something, the foreclosure, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have moved the people out of their homes. So that list does not prove that that person doesn't still live in that house.
So you're making the point that just because you're on a foreclosure list, it doesn't mean you have been kicked out of your home. So let's take that first. We know there are going to be challengers from both parties at the polling places. Will you not allow a challenge of someone if their name is on a foreclosure list? Will you not, you know, because there's challenge books that people can sign up, and you're not going to allow that?
You know something? No, we do not believe that a person's name on a foreclosure list is sufficient basis on which to challenge.
Okay, so
and we
that.
Have given information out to all the local clerks so that the election workers know that is not sufficient evidence that person does not live there.
But what if someone's not in their home? What are people calling and saying to you?
What they're calling about is they want to know if they're registered and where they're registered at. And, you know, if they say to us, you know, we have moved out of our home, then we're telling them to register where you live. You know, they have up until Monday, October 6th, to register.
And what do they think? Because we're understanding that somehow it's gotten across to people that you can't vote unless you own a home.
Yeah, that is really, that you do not have to be a homeowner to vote in Michigan. And so people need to know their home is foreclosed on. Certainly they're suffering enough. And they need to know that if they are still in that house, they can vote. If they are not in that house, they can still vote up to 60 days.
But what if they're, you know, sleeping on a friend's couch? We're reading in the New York Times about a 33-year-old home builder who was foreclosed. He moved to another town to live with his parents, had no idea that he was supposed to update his registration information. As he said, boy, when you're foreclosed on, I've moved several times, and it's not top of mind. So how are you communicating to those people who might be in homeless shelters? How do you let them know that they have to re-register, even if it's registering a friend's, you know, couch and address?
It's by the radio. It's by what's on TV. It's in the newspaper. We definitely, on our website, we have information. But, you know, we're not going to get all the information out. And really, the best we can do is, you know, by the radio announcements, is on TV. And there is a lot of information coming out now in Michigan about people registering to vote. I don't know if there's that much information about the foreclosure, though, and that's the part that bothers me.
Carmela Sabaugh, Macomb County Clerk, Register of Deeds, talking about how foreclosures are being handled in Michigan when it comes to voting. Carmela, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
So again, voter registration deadlines vary state to state. That October 6th deadline we just mentioned is for Michigan. and more than a dozen other states, you can go to our website, here-now.org, to find out your state's deadline. You're listening to Here and Now. Illustrator and author Sandra Boynton is best known for her lively children's books with friendly hippos, penguins, and pigs in fantastically silly scenarios. In books like Hey, Wake Up! The Barnyard Dance and Moo Ba La La La, the stories are told in sing-song prose, and sometimes the characters just plain sing. That's because Sandra Boynton is also a talented songwriter. Her book Blue Moo was her fourth released with a CD.
Have you ever heard a sound, a melancholy air, so distant?
That's the title song, Blue Moo, performed by the legendary Steve Lawrence. Sandra also lined up Brian Wilson, Neil Sedaka, Davy Jones, formerly of the Monkees and Broadway. Well, now the CD from the book has been released by itself, and we thought we'd reprise our conversation with Davy Jones and Sandra Boynton when Blue Moo was published last year.
The magic of the blue, blue.
Well, your three previous albums have sold more than 500,000 copies each. You produced them all with your musical partner and neighbor, Michael Forbe. And on Blue Moo, most of them are performed by many former teen idols. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, this jukebox era music is from the 50s and 60s. And when I started working on these songs with Mike, I very much wanted that sound. So they're new songs that sound as if they're back from then. And it occurred to me, why not get the original singers from the era to do that? Davy Jones and Neil Sedaka and Steve Lawrence, Brian Wilson. So that was the idea behind it. And luckily, they all said yes. So it was an amazing experience to work with these people in the studio.
Well, you mentioned Davy Jones. He's one of the performers. Let's just listen first to the song he performs, Personal Penguin.
I want to be your personal penguin. I want to walk right by your side. I want to be your personal penguin. I want to travel with you far and wide. Wherever you go, I'll go there too. Here and there and everywhere and always with you. I want to be your personal penguin from now on.
It's right up there with Last Train to Clarksville, and Davy Jones joins us on the line from Florida. Davy, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be in company with both of you beautiful ladies, Robin, Sandra. Oh, my goodness.
Why did you say yes?
I'll tell you one thing, yep. Because it's my kids. I have four daughters, and when I mentioned Sandra Boynton's name, they said, you know, delightful. It's adorable. You know, Dad, we play it to the kids all the time, and I got credibility all of a sudden. They come to see me when I perform, and, you know, I do many shows, and they say, Dad, we don't get it. We just don't get it, you know, and finally they get it.
A whole new generation will now know Davy Jones.
I think so, and, you know, to be in the same company as people like, you know, Neil Sedaka and Brian Wilson and Bobby V. And not only that, there is a group on the album called The Sparklets. One of the young ladies is Sandra's daughter.
You know what, David? We've got The Sparklets here. Let's listen. It's a young girl group with one of Sandra's daughters in the middle. Let's listen.
Tell me, have you heard a sound, sad and far away? Maybe it is calling you.
And Sandra, you know, it occurs to me that what you've done here, it's so multi-generational, and it's going to delight not just the kids as they read along, but the parents as they have the memories. And Davy, with that in mind, I just have to make a full disclosure here. It wasn't just Marcia Brady that headed a Davy Jones fan club. Prior to the Monkees, you were an acclaimed Broadway actor, the Artful Dodger in Broadway's Oliver. You probably remember the former president of the New York chapter of the Davy Jones fan club. You had to talk to me at the stage door frequently. I was like 10, and I had to consult with you at the stage door of Oliver. Actually, In fact, that's why I went to see the Beatles at the Ed Sullivan Show, because as an office holder in your fan club.
Yeah, 1964, I performed on the Ed Sullivan Show.
And you gave some of us from your fan club tickets. We'd come to see you, Davy Jones, in scenes from Oliver, and then the Beatles were also there as well, which was fine.
Well, you know, I used to be a heartthrob. Now I'm a coronary. But you're talking at this particular point. I honestly... Sandra, I'm getting requests for my personal penguin.
Oh, are you? Oh, that's
great. It's scaring me. It's scaring me.
I'm amazed, though. It's wonderful that Robin was the president of your fan club when she was 10. Robin, that's a wonderful, wonderful story.
I love that in your concerts, people are, you know, crying out for, you know, your personal penguin. And Sandra, I was online. I couldn't believe it. The video of Davy Jones performing My Personal Penguin. It's wonderful, but it's also had thousands of hits, you know, a whole new generation is checking it out. We want to listen to just a couple more songs. B.B. King did one for you. It's called One Shoe Blues. Let's listen.
Well, I woke up this morning, couldn't find my shoe. Yes, I woke up this morning and I couldn't find my shoe.
Sandra Boynton, working now with B.B. King, Davy Jones, and of course doing your illustrations as well. In fact, the Norman Rockwell Museum is planning a retrospective of your work to tour the country in 2009. Your thoughts on, you know, you started out with greeting cards.
I'm a very lucky person. I love what I do. I love the people I work with. Never in my life did I think I'd be working with Davy Jones or Brian Wilson or the great B.B. King. Having so much fun.
So, Sandra, let me ask you, do you ever think and put together, you know, Christmas time or birthday time, do you illustrate and send personal sort of like greeting cards? You know, a personal like card. I'm into letters. I write letters.
Davy Jones, I think you're angling for a Christmas card from Sandra Boynton.
Yes, I would love it. I would honestly love it. I would love to have it. It would just be a personal treasure on the mantelpiece, you know.
Sandra? But,
absolutely.
I mean, you must sketch a lot and do stuff.
I draw a lot, yes. No, you've got it, Davy. You can have a personal penguin card for Christmas.
Oh, thank
you'll
so
be getting
much.
That.
Oh, this is going to be good. I'm going to be taking this at Christmas time to Santa Barbara to my kids and showing them. I really know her.
Well, now that I have my own signed Davy Jones tambourine, my own tambourine has been signed by Davy Jones. It says, Sandra, peace and love, Davy Jones. And I go, oh, my goodness. My life is now complete.
Sandra gave me a beautiful, beautiful sweater, and it had a D on it, because this was what happened during the, you know, 60s, and, you know, when you were going out with somebody and you had a crush or wherever. And I wonder if, you know, we are now instigating through Sandra's works that kind of remembrance, that kind of occasion that seems to, maybe it's me and I'm getting a little older and I'm looking back and thinking, well, I had so many happy memories and so many memories of different occasions that were, you know, similar to a lot of people's experiences.
I wanna be your personal penguin from now on.
That's Davy Jones. We also spoke with author and illustrator Sandra Boynton. The CD of Blue Moo, 17 jukebox hits from way back never, with Sandra's lyrics and music by Sandra and Michael Ford, has just been released separately from the Blue Moo book. Oh, in this note, we hear from Sandra that she did send Davy his own personal penguin card this past Christmas. So now we hope he has even more cred with his kids. We leave you one more song from the Blue Moon. This is Brian Wilson singing Speed Turtle.
Biggest compact streamlined built to last. Shiny green and so incredibly fast. It's a speed turtle. Oh, oh, it's a speed turtle. Oh, no. Man alive, it's in overdrive. Go ahead, turtle. A little humming noise and moves like lightning. It's super soft, power is the little bit brightening. Go, speed turtle, go, speed turtle. And when that maniac is going, well, hang on to your hat. It can tear across the road in just 3 hours flat.